William Gibson coined the word cyberspace, and his early works dealt with humans and virtual reality. His latest book, Zero History, is set in the present and deals with fashion, branding, and marketing. William, welcome to KBOO.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
For someone who invented the genre cyberpunk, basically, that's how you're known.
Yes.
But you've kind of abandoned speculative fiction. Why is that?
Well, I don't actually think I've abandoned speculative fiction. I think I'm writing speculative fiction about our strange and unknown present that we're all inhabiting.
What do you mean by a strange and unknown present?
Well, the world we live in today doesn't seem to me to be business as usual, as even as we knew it in the 20th century. We live, I think, literally in a world of exponential change, driven almost entirely by emergent technologies, which no one legislates into existence. They just emerge, we use them, and they change us. And then we have to play catch-up and try to legislate after the fact.
But isn't it true we've never had technology legislated into existence? I mean, technology is one of those things that kind of grows out of people's imaginations.
Well, that is true. It's true literally, but the rate of change has usually been sufficiently modest that we could sort of legislate in tandem. I mean, this isn't the first time we've had a sort of change bubble come up. The Victorians went through one, and our sort of popular cultural idea of the Victorians as being sort of gung-ho for the railroads and gung-ho for iron girders and gung-ho for building bridges is not really the whole story. If you go back and look at people's diaries and really, really dig into it, you find individuals who are sort of driven crazy by the rate of technological change. Or if you find individuals who were really, really repelled by their first ride on a steam train and profoundly disoriented by it.
Yeah, but it seems like the Victorians, we've got these technological changes that keep coming at us. And it's almost like, well, you can either hold on and go for the ride, or you're left behind in a world that is somewhat bewildering.
Yeah, or you can go for the ride and be somewhat bewildered, which I think a lot of us do.
So you see your work as still being speculative, even though it's based in the present.
Well, I think all fiction is by its nature speculative. Like each author is attempting to construct some sort of model of reality as that author perceives it. I think history is fundamentally a speculative discipline.
A lot of history is actually fiction.
Yeah, yeah. But I think that science fiction, as we've known it culturally in my lifetime, has been culturally afforded specific kinds of license, which is what most of us think about when we think about science fiction. But I think that the toolkit that science fiction accumulated through the late 19th and through the 20th century seems to me to be the very, very best toolkit with which to pick up the crazy steaming casserole that is 2010 and sort of try to get a look at the ingredients.
What kind of tools do you see in that toolkit?
A kind of special kind of objectivity, viewpoint characters. Viewpoint characters who are alien in some sense to the culture.
Not necessarily the, aliens, but no, just outside of the...
Yeah, well, the aliens are in science fiction are a stand-in for foreigners, really. That's what, symbolically, that's about. It's the foreign...
Well, they are kind of the ultimate foreigners.
Yeah, they're the ultimate foreigners. So that's the function that they serve in a certain kind of science fiction. One of the characters in Zero History has been addicted to prescription tranquilizers for a decade and hasn't had a credit card or a driver's license for a decade, probably hasn't had a telephone number, and because of that he's become an alien. And he's like, characters like that are wonderful for me because I can walk an alien through the world as I see it today and not have, and with a character who doesn't take any of it for granted.
Right.
And who can ask, he can ask questions that it wouldn't occur to me to ask. Because, you know, I have that same sort of, well, you know, this is the world. Let's, you know, we all take it for granted to some extent. But when you're freed of that, the world, when you're freed of that, the world around you starts to look miraculous and grotesque and bizarre and amusing, all at the same time.
Yeah.
And that's... I don't know if there's a name. I don't think there's a name for that, but that's one of the basic tools. That's one of the basic tools you have to master when you learn to write science fiction. And if I were trying to teach someone to write science fiction, I would say you've got to get used to the idea that the way things are right here and now is only one possibility. And once you get used to that, you'll be able to start to imagine the way things might work if one element of here was radically altered.
Right.
So it's a science. I think science fiction is fundamentally a subversive modality in sort of anti-authoritarian. Anti-status quo modality, because as someone, I can never remember who said, the purest basis of insubordination is curiosity.
That's great.
Yeah.
So the title of the book, Zero History, comes from Milgram. He's the character who has been in rehab for so long that he's kind of become an alien in his own culture.
Well, he's only been in rehab for 6 months or something, but he spent the previous decade so zoned out that he missed it.
Right. But is there, in some sense, that the Zero History also refers to the way that this culture kind of ignores history and blasts forward without a look at the past?
Well, I chose it, taking more responsibility. I chose it because I knew that it was ambivalent. So it can be a reference. It can be a reference to that. It can be a sort of reference to that wacky neoconservative idea of the end of history, that it was all over. I'm fond of things that are ambiguous, and titles particularly that are ambiguous and multiply resonant. So it can mean a number. I chose it because it could mean a number of things. But then I have the excuse of going, well, Milgram has zero history. I also like it as the idea of what what the state says when they don't know anything at all about something or someone. You know, zero history. And they're never happy when they say that.
What do you mean?
Well, zero, zero history on a given target for the surveillance state is never a happy position for the surveillance state, because they're in failed position. They weren't able to obtain any history, and there's nothing in the files on this person or that organization. So zero history is something they don't want to hear.
So some of these ideas are carryovers from your previous book, Spook Country, because a lot of that's involved in the surveillance society.
Yeah. Well, this is a surveillance society. A surveillance society isn't something that we're moving toward. It's something we already have. It depends on where you live. If you live in London, you have it like almost comically. And if you live here, maybe not so. Maybe not so much. But you know, people were upset about the NSA harvesting everybody's email. One of the things that made it difficult to get people riled up about that enough to try to do anything about it was that at some cultural level, everybody had always believed that they were doing that anyway.
I think that's very true.
Yeah, people would say, I'm really angry because the CIA is reading my mail. And there'd always be somebody in the coffee shop would say, fool, the CIA's been reading your mail forever. And they believe it. And it's actually not true, but it's true at some mythic level that makes it really, really difficult to mobilize people to protest an actual violation in that direction. That's amazing, really.
Well, I think that's part of the whole propaganda that's put out about organizations like the NSA and the CIA, because especially like the CIA are presented as all, you know, mythically huge and invincible. And then when you look at the actual history of the organization, it's like one failure after another.
Yeah.
But we're kind of soaked in image rather than reality.
Yeah, we are. A lot of that image, though, is generated by our... I think it's that image is generated more powerfully by our popular culture than it ever is by the CIA's PR people. Like, it's a story we're telling ourselves. And if you look at what the current iteration of what the CIA... PR machine tells you the CIA is, it's rather, you know, it's not too far off what I imagine the truth to be historically. They fessed up to doing a lot of bad things. They kind of give you their job description and
it's kind of boring.
Yeah, it's kind of boring. And I think that's actually, my guess would be that's pretty much what it's like. But the thing that rules us really is how it works in our popular culture. It's the 24 version is what?
24?
The TV show, yeah. That vision of the intelligence machine and its mission.
Where the idea is that we're constantly on the edge of being overtaken by terrorists, and someone's got to rush in at the last minute.
There's a threat. Well, actually, the weird thing about that, and the reason I actually know from talking to some intelligence professionals about it at one point, the thing that really annoys them about it is that it actually depicts them as being incapable of having gathered any good intelligence.
Right, because they wouldn't have to jump in at the last minute.
Yeah, they wouldn't have to jump in at the last minute. And their whole, you know, the job they're supposed to do, they're supposed to know what's going to happen, so you don't have to jump in at the last minute.
Well, reality has shown them that, if you can't predict the fall of the Soviet Union, you've really got some lapses in your intelligence.
Well, that was, yeah, that's a strange one. The father of a friend of mine in, I think, 1969 or 1970 was a sort of a Pentagon technocrat guy. He was a civilian, but he worked with weapon systems and things. And he used to come down with a bottle of bourbon and argue with me and his son about Vietnam and what America should do. And that man often predicted to me exactly the collapse of the Soviet Union. I'm the only person I ever heard say that. And he said, you know, they're going to run out of money. He thought that they'd run out of food and there'd be food riots and that would do it, but it didn't even get that far. But everything else, he just kept saying they're cooking their books, they don't really make any money, they're getting deeper in debt, system doesn't work at all, it's deeply dysfunctional, and they're really dangerous, but we just have to hold the line and they'll fall apart. And I didn't have the imagination to see that that was even a possibility. I used to think, well, David, he's really out there.
Well, that's part of why reality now seems so odd, is there's all these things that have happened that a few years ago we would have said, oh, no, that would never happen, you know, or the people that are thinking that are way out there.
Yeah, well, that's why I started trying to find different ways to use my science fiction toolkit, really. Because if I started seriously trying to write science fiction about 1980, and if in 1980 I'd gone into a New York publisher's office and said, look, got an idea for a novel. Here's set in the future. Here's the scenario. Human activities have caused the climate to go completely out of whack. And it's just getting warmer and warmer and warmer. And that's not causing it to be warmer everywhere, but it's causing... It's like really strange, violent fluctuations in the planetary weather system. And I go, well, that's kind of cool. I'd say, and there's this global sexually transmitted plague that destroys the human immune system. And it's incurable. And they go, well, you know, one or the other. And I go, no, listen, the Soviet Union has collapsed. And by then they'd be showing me the door. It's
right.
You just can't deal with, it's the science fiction publishers anyway couldn't deal with that kind of science fiction. So once I realized that, I thought, well, I've done a reputable stint of writing stories set in imaginary futures. I think I'm going to try to take this toolkit and in a very science fiction-y way, go to work on the world outside the window and see what I get.
Okay, and so one of the tools we talked about is this idea of the alien. What's another one of the tools you see as in your science fiction toolkit?
Another one is the idea that everyone lives in someone else's future and in someone else's past, and that our assumptions about the way things are, I don't know if there's even a word for this, sort of chronocentric. Like our idea of what it's all about right now is very 2010. Somebody in 1945, their idea of how it's all about is very 1945. Somebody in 2030, they're very 2030. It's, I don't think that any of those three people scattered along the timeline is necessarily any wiser as to what's going on. The person in 1945 may actually understand some aspects of the world generally better than we do. So that's another one I don't really have a name for. It's sort of an atemporal viewpoint, training yourself to have a viewpoint that's sort of outside.
Again, it's the alien.
The timeline. Yeah, it's all a sort of anthropological objectivity, or the attempt at that, because you can never really get that. perfectly.
Because the idea is, with really good science fiction, what you're doing is standing back from the world and trying to get rid of your own cultural assumptions, like your 2010 view of the world, and look at it through the eyes of a character who might be either in the past or the future.
Yes. And historical fiction, even the particularly really serious historical fiction, has more in common with really good science fiction set in an imaginary future than it does with anything else. Like, if you really want to look at the all the finest moves in terms of describing alien worlds and completely alien experiences, there's no better place to go than really, really well done historical fiction, where the writers had to not just research but project themselves into that world and get beyond our 2010 popular conception of what it was like to be a Victorian person, say, or what it was like to be a cowboy. That was what was so good about Deadwood. They did that with the Western. Like, they said, well, what would it really have been like if these had really been human beings living in the American West, doing all of the really messy and frequently very dubious criminal stuff that human beings do.
Right, instead of whitewashing it with a view that we have.
And the great thing that Deadwood was able to do with that is that once they did that, it created, like, automatically a mirror of who we are. You know, it started to resonate with a sense of who we are today and where we came from.
Because it was a more honest view of where we came from.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking about that the other day because someone was talking about the Muslim world and the stress that's put on men because of the gender apartheid. But if you look back in history, for example, in the plantations in the South, they had doorways that were men's doors and other doorways that were women's doors. So there were certain places that only men could go, and only, so we had that same sort of gender apartheid in our past.
We absolutely did. That's nothing unique to, there's nothing unique to Islam in that. It's just that we also had a Reformation and a lot of other change, and our society is increasingly less ruled by religious hierarchies.
Right.
But we used to be ruled by religious hierarchies. We used to, but you know, and it wasn't that long ago, back in Europe where we came from, we burned witches and heretics at the stake, drop of a hat, stoned people, issued fatwas. We did it all.
But there seems to be kind of a cultural amnesia about it.
Well, it's more like a cultural ignorance, actually. It's just we have to be taught about that. I mean, I didn't really understand those things until I was an undergraduate. I don't think I understood them in high school. And to the extent that I did understand that that's where we were coming from, I'd gotten it from science fiction. I hadn't gotten it from textbooks or from my teachers.
Given how much technology has changed the way we live on a day-to-day basis, what do you see as the future of storytelling? Do you see the technology impacting the way we tell stories to each other?
Well, I think there's been remarkably little change in how we tell stories in spite of all of these platforms that we keep coming up with to do it. I mean, one of the things I thought as I was leaving the theater after seeing Christopher Nolan's Inception for the first time was that it would be real. I thought that would be really hard to tell as prose fiction. And that's not something that occurs to me very often with film, particularly not with science fiction film anyway. Usually you could do a novelization of most science fiction films fairly readily if you were unfortunate enough to have to do a novelization of a science fiction film. But when I started thinking about Inception, I thought, this is very difficult. The point of view, this time structure stuff, it would be kind of a serious assignment to try to render that effective as a film, but tell it in prose fiction. And it's usually easier in prose fiction.
Well, do you think the reason that so far the technology hasn't impacted the way we do storytelling is because we haven't had enough years to work at it and to really see what the possibilities are with the different mediums? I mean, because human beings have been telling each other stories verbally for a millennium, so we've had a really long time to hone that skill.
Yeah.
But being able to manipulate images is kind of a different skill.
It's possible, but, you know, I wouldn't deny the possibility, but it's such a kind of huge thing to consider that it's one of those things where there are points where my imagination just sort of stops. I go, maybe, but I can't imagine it, but you may well be right.
Okay, well, it has been absolutely fascinating talking with you. My guest today has been William Gibson. We've been talking a little bit about his book, Zero History. And William, thank you so much for coming into KABU.
Well, thank you. It was very enjoyable.